The headlines, Press TV celebrates 15 years of relentless news coverage, remaining true to its mandate despite facing numerous restrictions. Israeli fighter jets strike Syria's Mediterranean coast with several missiles. And the United States unveils an $820 million weapons package for Ukraine, which includes advanced air defense systems. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Press TV is marking its 15th anniversary. The news network was launched in 2007 with the goal of providing an alternative voice and an extensive coverage of stories that mostly go uncovered or underreported by Western mainstream media outlets.
Hello, everyone. It's 8:30 a.m. here in Tehran. You're watching the news here on Press TV. A warm welcome from me, Hassan Tabikoli.
And from me, Saeed Purza.
Press TV is celebrating 15 years since it first started broadcasting in 2007. The 24-hour English news and documentary network is a subsidiary of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. In addition to its hourly newscasts, Press TV airs numerous commentary programs, roundtable panel discussions, and documentary-style films on topics varying from international politics to society and culture. Press TV differs from established or dominant types of media in terms of production, distribution, and content. Its aim has been to offer different narratives at a time when many feel their voices are not heard through the clutter of political rhetoric and the general disregard for objectivity. The network tries to offer more to its viewers and to interact with them in a different way. Press TV also launched its website in 2007 to give its audience a front-row seat to the biggest stories in the world. With its headquarters in Tehran, the network runs several offices and bureaus around the world. Throughout its life, Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship on multiple fronts. The channel has in the past been taken off the air by Eutelsat, Intelsat, and Asiasat over its outspoken criticism of Israel and the Western foreign policy agenda in Europe and Asia. The network's social media accounts and pages have also been repeatedly blocked by YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook in violation of free speech. Last year, the FBI seized the domain PressTV.com in an unprecedented measure under the pretext of U.S. sanctions laws. Yet, in the face of all adversity, Press TV has remained committed to its objectives, and the network now rightfully claims a place among the digital media network globally.
A strong quake hits Iran's southern province of Hormozgan, leaving at least five people dead. The deaths have been reported in a village in Bandar-e-Kamir, which is the epicenter of the magnitude 6.3 quake. Local authorities say dozens others are also wounded in several houses have been destroyed. At least 11 aftershocks have shaken the area so far. Rescue operations are underway in the affected zones. Iran's foreign minister says the country will continue its rational and robust efforts to have the sanctions against the country removed through negotiations. In a tweet, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the talks can succeed if the U.S. is realistic and Iran receives durable guarantees for its full economic benefit from an agreement. Earlier this week, Iran and the U.S. concluded 2 days of indirect talks mediated by the EU in Doha. Tehran says that it will coordinate with the EU on the next stage of the talks. The diplomatic process sought to break a stalemate in Vienna negotiations to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. The agreement entailed sanctions relief on Iran in return for restrictions on its nuclear program. It was left in tatters following the U.S. unilateral withdrawal in 2018. Political commentator Robert Fontina says that the United States' unrealistic demands have been the main obstacles to reviving the 2015 deal.
The United States will not make any changes. The United States is, as it has been from the start of the talks to rejuvenate the JCOA, has been unrealistic in its demands. The United States violated the agreement, therefore it must unilaterally re-enter the agreement. There is no reason for any discussions. Iran does not have to make any further concessions. The United States violated the agreement, which was a violation of international law, and the United States needs to come back into it. That President Joe Biden is not willing to do so indicates that the U.S. is not serious about the agreement and has no real interest in maintaining it. It will only do so if it to its knees, which has not happened since Trump pulled out in 2018, and is not going to happen. So the United States is causing this stalemate, and it is the United States that can release it and start constructive talks by being realistic once again.
Israel conducts fresh airstrikes on Syria, firing several missiles on the south of the second largest Mediterranean port city, Tartus. At least two civilians are injured. The Syrian Defense Ministry says the missiles hit poultry farms near the town of Hamidiya. It says that they were fired from the Mediterranean Sea. Israel frequently targets areas inside the crisis-hit Arab country. The attacks mainly target positions of resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terror groups. Syria has time and again denounced Israeli acts of aggression and lodged official complaints with the UN and other international bodies. Damascus says it reserves the right to respond to the Israeli aggression. The United States announces an additional $820 million worth of military aid to Ukraine to help the country in its fight against Russia. The Pentagon says the aid package includes surface-to-air missile systems and counter-artillery radars tackling Russia's long-range attacks. These are in addition to artillery and other ammunition. Washington has so far pledged a total of nearly $7 billion in military assistance to Kiev since the beginning of the war. Russia began its military campaign in Ukraine in February. Moscow has repeatedly warned the West against providing Ukraine with weapons, saying that the arms deliveries amount to a proxy war by the U.S. and its allies against Russia. More news from Ukraine. Powerful explosions have rocked the southern city of Mykolaiv a day after missile attacks in the Odessa region. Officials in Mykolaiv urged citizens to stay in shelters as the explosions rocked the city early on Sunday. We don't know what caused those blasts. There has been no reports of possible casualties either. On Friday, 21 people were killed when missiles hit an apartment building in the southern Odessa region. Ukrainian officials blamed Russia, but Moscow denied striking the building, saying its forces do not target civilians. To eastern Ukraine now, fighting goes on for the control of the Donbass region. Governor of Lysychansk, which is now the main battleground in the east, says Russians are shelling the city from all directions. Moscow says it has taken an oil refinery there. Staying with Ukraine, Russia continues to make gains in the Donbass region. Johnny Miller travels to frontline cities of Gorlokova and reports on the situation.
The town of Olomskia. 8 years of war have left their mark. The streets are eerily deserted as the front line is close. The cultural center was hit a few days ago. It now serves as the town hall. From inside, I am pointed out a Russian monument. While I'm filming the boom of outgoing artillery, two people were killed at the monument this week. The building, like the streets outside, feels like a ghost town. But inside, I find Elena, the head of the council administration.
People run quickly to the shops, buy what they need, and run home. People are simply afraid of going out. I can't say how people live in the west of Ukraine, but this is how we live here. We hope for peace soon so we can start to rebuild the town.
The school has been hit many times, as is the market and the hospital.
Now, while elsewhere in Ukraine, it's very easy to level the accusations that Ukraine is shelling civilians and civilian areas, here in this town, it's a little bit harder to do so because, frankly, the front line is only around 50 metres or 100 metres around this town, and there's the almost constant sound of outgoing artillery as well. So Ukrainians may well just be trying to hit these artillery pieces rather than just aiming at civilians.
Incredibly, in this desolate place, some civilians still live here, although most cower inside.
So what is it like to live here?
It's bad, my nerves are shredded and it's always tense. What kind of a state is Ukraine that kills its own people, sending brother against brother? We are hoping soon for victory.
In the adjacent city of Golovka, I meet the well-known mayor, Ivan Prokhodko. He uses a Ukrainian flag as the doormat to his office.
This flag lying over there symbolizes the criminal state of Ukraine, not its people. The flag is my personal trophy as well. I took it at the front line. I was born in Donetsk and I loved Ukraine. But those who took power in 2014 in the coup trampled over democracy, and they do not care about the citizens of the East.
Who do you blame for the breakup of Ukraine?
The answer is obvious. NATO countries are to blame, in particular the United States. They needed Ukraine as a hotbed of tension at the border with Russia. You see, I'm for democracy. In 2014, they should have asked what people wanted. But nobody was interested in people's opinion. That's why we have got what we have now. We have a terrible war, dead Ukrainians, dead Russians. It's really horrible. And those who draw benefit from it are sitting across the ocean.
While Russia calls this war a special military operation, Ukraine calls it an invasion. But here in Donbass, the pro-Russian civilians call it a liberation operation. With the Russian army making gains not far to the north of these desperate streets, the 8 years of war in this town might finally be set to end. Jenny Milikolovka.
The Western military alliance NATO wrapped up its three-day summit in Spain on Thursday. NATO leaders adopted a firm stance against Russia and took aim at what they called China's challenges. That marks a shift in the alliance's policy towards the two powers. So let's find out why that happened at a time of escalating tensions between the East and the West.
NATO leaders have held a meeting in the Spanish capital Madrid to discuss the expansion of the military alliance. NATO has formally invited Sweden and Finland to join the US-led military alliance. This is a historic expansion of the 30-member bloc. The military bloc, in a collective decision, approved the applications of Sweden and Finland a day after Turkey dropped its objections to the move. The decision will now be referred to the parliaments and legislators of the NATO member states for final ratification. The process is likely to move swiftly as the US-led military alliance seeks to build a bigger front against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO after Russia launched a special military operation in its neighbor Ukraine in February. NATO has officially declared Russia the most significant and direct threat to the security of its members. That marks a radical strategic shift spurred by the Russian military offensive against Ukraine.
It's the first time this new vision of Russia and its role in Europe is reflected in the strategic document of the Atlantic Alliance. Until recently, until this summit, NATO operated within the framework of the old strategy that was adopted back in 2010 at the Lisbon summit. And this strategy described Russia as a strategic partner of the NATO alliance. So we have a very decisive, a very radical shift in the approach.
And for the first time in its history, NATO has listed China as one of its strategic priorities. claiming that Beijing's ambitions challenge the Western bloc's interests, security, and values. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says China is not a threat, but the alliance needs to be clear-eyed about the challenges it represents.
This shift will definitely color many new initiatives and steps taken by NATO, including its defense posture, its deployment patterns, including its rhetoric. So it is a kind of very important formal step which nails down the new normal and which will have a significant impact of what NATO is likely to plan in years to come.
Moving on to Sudan now, people have taken to the streets of Khartoum for another day of protests against the country's military coup. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowds. On Thursday, nine people were shot dead by security forces during massive demonstrations. The recent deaths bring the total number of protesters killed to over 110 since the start of the coup 8 months ago. Demonstrators are demanding the return to civilian rule. Months-long unrest in Sudan led to the ouster of a former president Omar al-Bashir in 2019. A subsequent power-sharing deal struck between the military and civilians was scrapped in a coup on October 2021. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Joe Biden once vowed to make Saudi Arabia a pariah, but now he's looking to rebuild relations and many expect normalization with the Israeli regime to be on the agenda, says Khaled Amire, writer, in an article published under the heading Biden effort to rehabilitate U.S.-Saudi relations likely to include normalization with Israeli regime. Stay tuned for more. Political observers of the West Asia region are predicting U.S. President Joe Biden will seek to strike a major deal with Saudi Crown Prince and de facto King Mohammed bin Salman during Biden's upcoming visit to the kingdom, slated for mid-July, during which time He will also visit the occupied Palestinian territories and the West Bank. Biden is reportedly scheduled to attend the summit in Riyadh on July 6 with a number of Arab leaders besides MBS and or his aging father, King Salman, including the Egyptian president, Iraqi prime minister, Jordan's king, and the Emir of Qatar. Last week, the Zionist regime prime minister Naftali Bennett said that integrating Israel into the region was the main goal of Biden's upcoming visit to the region. The Jewish regime views normalization with Saudi Arabia as a strategic watershed which might lead to far-reaching changes in the political map of the West Asia region. If the Zionist regime's media is any indication, the Israeli establishment is quite enthusiastic that such a move would lead to a significant marginalization of the conflict with the Palestinians, which wouldn't seem to deter Saudi leaders. Mohammed bin Salman is widely known for his disillusionment with the Palestinian issue and is reputed to have told American Jewish leaders in 2018 that the Palestinians should take the proposals the Trump administration was offering at the time or shut up and stop complaining. This could be his chance to further that agenda. The Israeli apartheid regime, which occupies Islam's third holiest sanctuary after Mecca and Medina, must be hoping that a genuine normalization with the Saudis would significantly boost the Zionist regime's standing in the region. Israel would undoubtedly view normalization with Saudi Arabia, the native birthplace of Islam, as a great victory that is more or less equivalent, at least in its moral weight, to the Six-Day War victory over the Arabs in 1967, explained London-based Palestinian journalist Abdul Bari Atwan. He said the Saudi pendant was the ultimate prize the fake regime of Israel has been dreaming of ever since former U.S. President Donald Trump started his normalization frenzy nearly 4 years ago. Saudi King Salman affirms on every occasion the traditional position of the kingdom towards the Palestinian cause, namely that Saudi Arabia won't recognize Israel or normalize relations as long as the Palestinian issue remains unresolved. This traditional stance has been reiterated several times by Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud. However, MBS doesn't seem to believe that the Palestinian issue ought to have a veto impact on Saudi freedom to pursue its national interest with other states and regimes, including the fake regime of Israel. Saudi Arabia is not just another country. It is looked as the Qibla of Muslims, which ought to represent the collective conscience of the Ummah of Prophet Muhammad. In a nutshell, normalizing with the Zionist regime is simply incompatible with the sublime status of Haram al-Sharif, which remains under Israeli regime occupation and would likely remain so following Saudi normalization. More to the point, there are real fears that a de facto Saudi embrace of Israeli expansionism and Lebensraum-like policies would encourage some reluctant Muslim states, as described in the Israeli regime media, such as Pakistan, Tunis, and Indonesia, to embark hastily toward normalization with the Zionist regime. Needless to say, such precipitous moves would effectively deal with the Palestinians cause a fatal blow, which could spell its liquidation, at least as far as the Zionist regime is concerned. From the Palestinian point of view, a full Israeli-Saudi normalization, especially in the absence of any genuine Israeli commitment to the end of the occupation of the West Bank, including Al-Quds, would be the greatest Arab betrayal of the Palestinian cause since former Egyptian President Anwar Sadat visited Al-Quds and delivered a speech before the Israeli regime parliament in 1979. That visit, it is widely believed, eventually led to Sadat's assassination several months later. Western, including American media, generally ignore the all-too-obvious fact that all Arab regimes that have reached normalization agreements with the fake regime of Israel thus far are ruled by tyrannical despots and notorious human rights violators. Interestingly, Saudi Arabia happens to sit at the top of political despotism in the Arab world. This means that normalization with the Zionist regime is only formal in nature and can hardly be considered as reflecting the popular will in normalizing countries, including Morocco, UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan. It is very unlikely that the Zionist regime would promise either the Saudis or the Americans any genuine concessions with regard to East Al-Quds and Haram al-Sharif. That is apart from the symbolic gestures of goodwill, which would mean very little given the Zionist regime's notorious parsimonious negotiating patterns and arrogance. However, any concession by the Zionist regime that might significantly mitigate her grip on the occupied territory, especially the Islamic holy places in Al-Quds and Al-Khalil, would be highly unlikely in light of the Zionist regime's history of recalcitrance on such issues. Nonetheless, to help the Saudis keep face, the Biden administration might give them certain vague and loosely worded assurances regarding the Palestinian problem. However, from experience, such assurances would be utterly worthless and insignificant, as the strong side, in this case, the fake regime of Israel, would eventually adopt its own tendentious and skewed interpretation of these assurances, effectively eviscerating them of any real content. The Biden administration might not object to selling Saudi Arabia advanced weapons, including the F-35 fighters, especially if MBS pledged to make the normalization full, comprehensive, and irreversible, as the Emiratis have done. But such a high level of normalization with a regime whose troops are seen routinely murdering innocent Palestinians and demolishing Palestinian homes on a daily basis could boomerang unexpectedly on the Saudi monarch sooner or later. Joe Biden might seem careful not to seem to appear too close or too eager to normalize with Mohammed bin Salman, whom he had vowed to make a pariah, but this is occurring only in public. As to what goes on behind the curtain, that is quiet, a different story.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sesdy. He's a professor of international.
the Spotlight.
It started out with blasting Russia as being a world threat, and it ended with the same. Add to it more military aid, NATO's expansion, along with additional troops and new members. This time around, China was added to the list of being a threat. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S.-led NATO preaches safety, but is endangering the world through its militaristic approach. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Author and commentator John Stepling joins us from Inderøy, Norway. Also joining us is journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Marseille in France.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, John Stepling. When you take a look at this summit, which in many regards is a U.S.-led NATO gathering, what are we looking at when it comes to what it really spelled out? Was there anything new in that, except for the fact that it added China to a list of possible threats to the world?
I mean, they said China out loud, but everybody knew China was already on the list of sort of targets. you have to understand, I think, and it's almost difficult to believe in a sense, but the delusional level at which American foreign policy operates, and the real crux of this conflict is NATO expansion, of course, the eastward expansion of NATO. Back when James Baker was Secretary of State, you know, he promised to Gorbachev NATO would not expand one inch eastward. I think at that time there were 17 countries in NATO. Today there are 30, because they promptly broke that promise, and in 91, in 2004, 2007, they kept expanding Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, etc. And then, you know, the real sort of the red line was Ukraine and Georgia. And, you know, even commentators and political analysts on the right and conservatives like Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense, in his memoirs in 2014, at the very end of the book, he says, Ukraine and Georgia, the idea of them as candidates for NATO inclusion was reckless overreach. Even people like Henry Kissinger, George Kennan, when these are people that are warning it's a bad idea, I mean, you know, you wonder what's going on in the heads of people at the Biden administration. But the U.S. desperately needs a long, protracted war. It's an economic imperative, in a sense. I mean, the U.S. has to have a villain. They have to sell armaments. They have to create conflicts. And right. And when Putin took power in 2000, remember, he actively wanted to join NATO. And everybody in the European Union saw that as, you know, quite possibly a good idea, mm-hmm. until the United States told them, no, that's a terrible idea, because sure. the U.S. had long-term plans.
Let's take some of the fluff out of this whole
summit's purpose, if we can, Elijah Magnier, through the lens that I'm about to paint a picture of, and I'd like to find out from you if this is an accurate reading of it, because when you take a look at it, they come out and they make this show of how they, what do they call it, a new force model, a new strategic blueprint, and then when you take a look at it, it's really reinventing Russia as a threat again, almost, except for the fact, like as I said, they've added China to that list. But are they doing that, presenting Russia as a threat, perhaps more forcefully, in order to make sure that there is a unity between the members to act out against Russia?
Exactly. Well, if we remember in 2018, President Emmanuel Macron of France said NATO is in coma, is dead brain, and he called for the formation of a new European army. What President Joe Biden has managed to do is to take away this idea of having a European army and change it into a NATO army by increasing the number of intervention force from 40,000 to 300,000. That's a big achievement for the U.S. administration. In fact, the aim is has multiple purposes in this summit in Madrid. First, to bring Europe together as one bloc with the U.S. Second, because Europe is not really in harmony with each other between the Eastern Europe and the Western Europe, and that the difference is even increasing further. So Biden wants to really have one command, that is the U.S. command, and bring the differences between the East and Western Europe under one leadership, and that he has managed to do. And third, consider Russia from 2010 being a strategic ally to becoming a strategic enemy. That's a huge change. But the aim is not really only Russia. It is China. And the U.S. fears, very concerned about China's excess of wealth, rapid military modernization, and leadership position in Asia, Middle East, and Europe. So the summit in Madrid has multiple objectives and goals that were achieved by the U.S., and the European continent is happy with it, even if it is dragged under the U.S. and paying the consequences.
I can't figure how that's going to happen if we were going to take a look at the big picture here, John Stepling. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. This is, okay, let's take a look at what Joe Biden has said. He has said that this war, I don't know how it's going to end, he said, but it will not end with Russia defeating in Ukraine, or defeating Ukraine, that is. So there you have that. You have Jens Stoltenberg has said that there's only a diplomatic solution to this at the table. But at the same time, Ukraine has to have the upper hand when it comes to its military posture on the ground. To me, that all sounds like this war is going to continue.
Yeah.
So where are we going to come in with NATO, or where are they going to come in terms of trying to now get all these countries to go after China? I mean, in terms of the EU, China was its number one trading partner just a few years ago.
Yeah. No, the U.S. absolutely. I mean, look, the U.S. has worked aggressively and feverishly to make sure there has been no diplomatic solution to this from the beginning, from day one. As soon as Zelensky would utter anything of a conciliatory nature, they would get another couple billion dollars in weapons shipped off immediately. This has been a long-term goal, though, of the neocon foreign policy contingency, and they hold very, very powerful positions again. The Rand Corporation published a paper that now is somewhat famous, just a few years ago, called Overextending Russia, How to Unbalance and Overextend Russia, something to that effect. It's available online. It spells out exactly what is taking place, that the idea is to provoke Russia into an armed conflict with Ukraine, overextend them, bleed them dry, turn it into another kind of Vietnam for Russia, which was the plan, of course, with Afghanistan way back. And this is the final chapter of that is regime change in Moscow. Now, what isn't said in that paper, but which is obvious, is that the next step after regime change in Moscow is regime change in Beijing. you know, these are insane ideas, of course, and the U.S., you know, what level of unreality they live in terms of their appraisals of relative power, I don't know. But the sanctions and all the actions so forth are already backfiring. I mean, the United States is suffering food shortages. The supply routes are interrupted. Supply chains are interrupted. We're seeing increased homelessness and despair, desperation. Gas prices are through the roof. There's huge inflation in building materials and so forth. So the U.S. is suffering far more than Russia is from any of this. But this speaks to the fear the U.S. has of a shift in power globally, that we're, you know, the BRICS agreement, that we're seeing, you know, India, China, Russia, Iran, South America forming alliances, and the U.S. is left out of this because nobody wants anything to do with the U.S.
Sure.
And they haven't for quite some time. And I think the U.S. is very slow to somehow recognize this. So they resort to their usual tactics of bullying and this sort of saber rattling.
Let's take a look about this idea of the unity that they are so keen on repeating out loudly, especially the U.S. president. And they say, you know, we have to keep the pressure on Russia. We have to make sure the sanctions are there. We have to make sure that we cut the revenues while we can. Well, statistics have come out saying that Russia earned 93 billion euros in revenues from fossil fuel exports in the first 100 days of the war. Well, at this point, we've passed that 100 days. Elijah Magnier, who do you think was this major buyer? The EU, 62% of this, worth approximately 57 billion euros. How is it then that they talk about exerting pressure on Russia when you have the EU being its number one importer of the fossil fuels?
Many European nations has decided to reduce their dependency on the Russian gas and oil. And they've started, France said they will reopen their coal factories, and they will depend for the electricity on coal. And they will start next winter is going to be very harsh on Germany and France particularly, and the rest of Europe. So who is providing this money? Mainly Europe, because it's still buying the Russian gas and cannot be independent for the next year or two, and still paying it for the higher price, because the price of oil has moved from being on $70 a barrel to between 113 today to 120. That difference brought a lot of money to Russia. Moreover, Russia is also selling to India and China. They both are very happy to receive this gas. And also there is another mockery in Europe, that Poland declared that it's no longer receiving the Russian gas, but suddenly Germany is pumping five times more from Russia than usual, because it's taking the gas from Russia and giving it also to Poland. So this masquerade is very well known, but Europe has decided and has selected this camp, and its camp is to pay the price. The population will pay the price. The inflation is between 8% to 10%, and it's going to go ahead with being totally with the U.S., with the U.S. objective, and has selected to be with the Americans against their own interests. That selection that is not going to change for the next 10 years.
Yeah, sure. Well, forget about trying to reduce climate change. Forget about all those plans, I guess, if you have these type of buying going on. Okay, John Stepling, you kind of painted the world for us when you talked about BRICS. And when I say that, I'm talking about trying to break down the world in terms of who's allied with whom. If you have the BRICS countries, if you're looking at Latin America, where you have most of those countries, if not all at this point, having leftist politicians who are leaning towards the East, somewhat trying to push back against, I guess, the West that has failed them in terms of their economic models. And then Africa, where the U.S. is on the back foot, not really to have penetrated it as much as China has. And then you have West Asia, or as it's called, Middle East, where many of the countries are moving to the East, Iran included. Even Saudi Arabia is sitting on the fence, so to speak. We'll find out how this trip by Biden works out. Then are we looking at a world that really the U.S. and its European partners are in the minority when it comes to the numbers, and therefore economically then that would mean that they're inferior towards the rest of the world?
Well, I think they are fearful, but you know, the so-called pink tide in Latin America, I think, rattled the establishment in Washington. They had not expected that. You remember they tried to orchestrate a coup in Bolivia. Well, they did, but it ultimately failed. They constantly are trying to undermine Maduro in Venezuela, and there's a lot of pressure against these leftist governments. But it's always failing at this point. The U.S. has made a huge pivot. It began with Obama, but they pivoted to Africa. They increased spending for AFRICOM enormously. They just appointed a new, the first black Marine general, four-star general, to oversee AFRICOM. Africa looms as very important to the U.S. They need the raw materials and so forth that are there. They are home to huge mining interests in Africa that they want to protect. So we're seeing a strange economic restructuring going on. And this is, you know, the backdrop to this, of course, is the so-called Great Reset, the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab and all these people.
Right.
And you can't ignore how that's factoring into this. But I think that if you took the temperature of the rest of the world outside of the EU, it is overwhelmingly in support of Russia. Nobody is fooled by the theatrics of this summit in Madrid, except apparently the leadership in Europe. But you know, you saw very quickly Finland and Sweden wanting to join NATO because suddenly Russia is being painted as an imminent existential threat. Why anybody thinks, you know, Russia would invade Sweden is beyond me. But
right.
but that's the level at which the rhetoric works in white Europe. But for the rest of the world, I think this narrative doesn't play nearly as well. And this has to be something the U.S. is worried about. It has to be. And I think it accounts for a lot of the aggressive tone of the Biden administration.
Well, the U.S. has not figured out what's going to happen with Ukraine yet. I mean, another tranche of military aid to the tune of $850 million, I believe, is the latest, which comes out and puts that over $5 billion, close to six, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe it has reached $6 billion. And what many people don't actually realize is the £2 billion that that the UK has actually added. So that's, $9 billion at this point. What we're looking at, Elijah Magnier, when it comes to this military assistance, is there's not a reality check here, because the facts on the ground are speaking in Russia's favor based on what's happening on the ground. What kind of game plan is there by pumping all this money when Ukraine is backtracking? I mean, and that's not the way they obviously describe it. So what is going on there?
Well, there is a reality from the Western point of view. And this reality is to continue fighting Russia as to the last Ukrainian, as long as Ukraine is happy to do the job on behalf of the U.S. So this is why the Americans have decided to support Ukraine with $53 billion and ship all the weapons possible that they can send to Ukraine, as long as the Ukrainian continue fighting, losing, but continue fighting. So Ukraine said that they need at least $5 billion a month to pay the salary and to, and they need more weapons. What's happening is irrelevant if Ukraine is losing territory, which it is, because Donetsk more or less is almost free now, and Lugansk, sorry, and then the move is to take the rest of Donbass.
Exactly.
So that's irrelevant for the Americans, because they keep engaging Russia on the ground, they keep demonizing Russia, they keep bringing the European all together under the thumb of the U.S. That's an achievement for the U.S. This is why Ukraine already chose its camp and can no longer change to stop the war, unless dictated by the Americans.
Well, the fact of the matter is, when you have a summit that puts China on a list John Stepling, and puts it almost in the same category as Russia, I mean, we're looking at how the world is suffering, not solely because of what's happening with the Ukraine conflict, but because of what Russia represents in terms of commodities and things like fertilizers also that is not highlighted. I mean, God save us if something is going to happen with China. You know, so for how much, how realistic is what NATO is preaching through the U.S. in terms of going after China?
Well, I mean, it's utterly unrealistic. But, you know, a lot of people have predicted this. I mean, John Pilger made a short film, a very good film, The Looming Coming War with China, some title like that. That's very good. I mean, he said this 10 years ago. The U.S. have been building bases in the South China Sea for the last 10 years, naval bases throughout the region. They've increased troops in South Korea, Japan. All of this was targeting China. They continue to make sort of insulting and bellicose remarks about Taiwan. That, you know, China just sort of endures and ignores because there's nothing backing it up. The U.S. economy is entirely dependent on war. I mean, those 900 military bases we always speak about around the world are the bedrock of the U.S. economy. It is what, you know, the U.S. does and sells. And if you look at China and Russia, they only have together something like 5 bases outside their borders. So we're seeing a different level of reality here. But China has enormous economic power, obviously. Russia has more economic power, I think, than the U.S. realized. If you read the Western press, though, this is not the story that you hear. And if you read even the New York Times, Washington Post, you would think Ukraine is winning this conflict. It's extraordinary. The first phase of this military incursion by Russia is essentially over. They, as your other guest said, they have liberated the Donbass region for all intents and purposes.
Okay.
And Ukraine is running out of soldiers. They're not running out of weapons, but they are running out of soldiers.
All right. So one thing not talked about here, which is going to draw this to a close, Elijah Magnier, is how we don't hear much about China's military capabilities. But I believe that China has done quite a lot in terms of trying to expand its capacities in one way or another within the military arena, perhaps even nuclear expansion and other areas. Do you think that there is a matchup there when you have not just China, but Russia and other countries, if the goal is to move ultimately to provoke China and then move on and confront China militarily?
I don't think China is interested in confronting the U.S. militarily. The United States has created an international rule and order to its liking, and that has started since the Second World War. And the U.S. believes that China, along with Russia, BRICS, Iran, are challenging this order. But China has built the wall to stay within it, but not to go and conquer other countries. China is interested in offering a different model than the U.S., than the unilateral hegemony of the world. This is why China is creating a fear in the U.S., because it's seeking for developing other countries to make them, to empower them and make them more independent and detach themselves from the U.S. This is what the Americans are afraid, and there is a fear in Washington that they believe either us or them, while China believes us and them. There is a space for everybody. And President Xi Jinping has become confident that China's economic system and governance model is enough to be in the international affair and arena without the need to be in a war with the U.S. or with any other country. However, China is supporting Russia here, and together they make a formidable adversary to the U.S. to discourage the U.S. from starting a war against China, but not to provoke the U.S. The provocation comes always from the U.S. side that feels threatened because it has started an inevitable decline. This is why China created fear for its power in wealth and in development technology. I mean, the Chinese have 5G that the U.S. haven't reached, so they can't accuse Chinese from copying everything. However, China is making carrier, jet carrier. They're making one every 6 months or a year. The U.S. needs several years. So there's a development that creates a real fear in the U.S.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in. We're fresh out of time. Elijah Magnier there, journalist and political analyst John Stepling. Thank you, author and commentator. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitahue and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
Today's tip, what are the differences between the formal ubudiyah and the informal ubudiyah when it comes to our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah.
Allah, Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, we are talking about the differences between formal ubudiyya and informal ubudiyya. Now, it might seem a little bit interesting and perhaps even rather strange for some of our listeners as to what can be formal ubudiyya and what can be informal ubudiyya. Now, of course, in some of the past programs, we did talk about, even though it was in general terms, what is formal ubudiyya and what is informal ubudiyya. Now, we wanted to devote this program specifically